You're very welcome to Burning Books, a Books Ireland podcast supported by the Arts Council of Ireland. For this episode, I'm talking with Martina Devlin, author of The House Where It Happened, About Sisterland, and many more. Her new novel, Edith, is based on the life of Edith Somerville, and it's out now with Lilliput Press. Martina, you grew up in Omagh, and I noticed that your very first choice, which is a book from your early years, your formative years, is also by an Omagh writer. So do you want to tell me a little bit about that book?
Yes, that's Benedict Kiely, or Ben Kiely, as he's always known in Omagh. And because he's from my hometown, through him, I saw that it was possible to become a writer. And I was very familiar with his work because it was in our house when I was growing up. And my favourite novel of his is a novella, in fact, Prox Opera, which was published in 1977 and then was reissued in 2015. And it prefigures the Omagh bomb by two decades. So it's about an elderly man, granddad Binchy, who's forced to drive a bomb into his local town. And it's clearly Omagh from the description. His family are being held hostage. It's concise, it's powerful, and it takes a single story and shines a light on the troubles and what Kiely calls the long, weary years of violence. And he dedicated that novella to the memory of the innocent dead.
Yeah, I love that. I love that. I was reading about that this morning, that phrase, memory of the innocent dead, says it all, really.
And significantly, his character, Binchy, is a retired teacher, and he stands for the values of an older Ireland. And these values are expressed through ballads and mythology, which is threaded through the work. And you absolutely sense Kiely's outrage that these values are being appropriated by the men and women of violence. And he says, could Pearse in the post office have by proxy summoned Cuchulainn to his side? Could all that delirium of the brave not have died by proxy?
Shivery. And did you come to that? Like, how was it coming to that as, I suppose, you were a teenager? Or yeah. What? And, you know, how did you come to it? Was it, I don't remember that being on like the curriculum or anything like that, or maybe it was.
It was in the house. My father bought everything by Benedict Kiely. Because, you know, when you come from not a huge town, there aren't a great many writers around, and there's enormous pride in people who achieve things, whether they're sports people or writers or artists or actors, politicians. It's the idea of someone from your small community making their mark on the world. So there was always great pride in Omagh about Benedict Kiely. And I never met him, but I did walk past him as a wee girl holding my daddy's hand. And he told me, you know, this is a great man, this is a writer. And I remember he was just leaning up against a wall chatting to people. He had a sonorous voice. I've heard him on radio a good bit. Sunday Miscellany was one of his regular slots, and he was just a natural born Shanachie.
And he has a short story competition now in his honour, isn't that right?
Yes, and there's a regular festival in Omagh in October. But you know, he was a great one for the folklore. And he was also an early admirer of Alice Milligan's, who was a poet and journalist and activist, also from the Omagh area. And he tells a great story in one of his collections of memoir about visiting her and the room getting smokier and smokier because of dead birds up the chimney. He saw her value at a time when she was being forgotten, really sidelined.
That's interesting, isn't it? And what you said about him there, about folklore also being, because like when you're telling me about that book, and you know, the memory of the innocent dead and the troubles, and you know, Ireland, and it's. I wanted to ask you a little bit about imagination and how that would fit into that kind of a novel, because, you know, it's something that's very important to you. And I've read anyway that you've talked about it before, that you know, was Anne Enright who said when books become a bounty, they kind of lose their magic in a sense, not lose their magic, but that's kind of the beginning of the end in a sense. But it wouldn't have been, it's not like that for that type of book, even though, yes, there is a sort of a concrete, it is about, in a sense, the troubles and, you know, our, the two rivers there that are kind of conflating. I'm not explaining myself very well, but I guess what I'm trying to say is imagination something that runs through his work and into other work that you admire and that you go to?
Well, imagination is the core of any book. I mean, look, we can be inspired as writers by the events around us, but in some way we have to transmogrify them into fiction, which is a different beast entirely. And yes, as Anne Enright says, when a book is too about you, you've lost. But at the same time, you can sneak in your messages.
Yeah.
It's hard sometimes as a writer to know what exactly you're doing till you're finished, because you're going on instinct. And then it's only when you've typed those magical words at the end.
When is it ever?
Yeah, but that you can see what you're doing. But with Ben Kiley, I'm very struck looking back over Prox Opera, which comes from proxy operation, a kind of a military term. I'm very struck by how he prefigured the Uma Bomb and how, as a fiction writer, you can change outcomes in a way that as a journalist or a biographer or a historian, you can't.
Yeah.
And so, for example, in Prox Opera, without spoiling it for anyone, there's a different outcome. Whereas if you were to write about the Uma Bomb, you cannot change the fact that that bomb detonated.
Yeah.
All those innocent people died. Kiley was able to reflect on the troubles but produce his own outcome.
Yeah, I just, you know, it's hard to talk about the Uma Bomb, isn't it, without just sort of having pause.
Well, I covered it as a journalist, which is possibly the most difficult journalistic work I ever did. I mean, look, I was sent deliberately because my news desk thought, well, Martina knows the area and also people here, she's from there. So I had this sense of being both of the community, but also slightly intruding because I was there to do a job. And I felt very protective of the community. I remember at one stage going around giving out to some of the overseas journalists that they were intruding on people's privacy from time to time and just to back off.
Yeah.
It was an odd situation of being both poacher and gamekeeper, but I did my best, is all I can say.
It was probably a degree of shock for you as well at the time.
But sure, I knew some of the people, you know. Of course I did. My first boyfriend's sister-in-law was one of those who died. I mean, I knew lots of them, and it was a huge shock to the community because, of course, it came 4 months after the Good Friday Agreement when a line was supposed to be drawn under everything. Yeah. And also, Uma hadn't suffered particularly in the Troubles over and above the awfulness of being in a war zone, if you like, but there hadn't been too much going on in the town itself, so this was an added shock. I mean, look, it was a community and still is a community where people get along with their neighbours as best they can.
Yeah. Well, Prox Opera, just for our listeners again, Prox Opera should definitely be on your list. Going to something very different, but also in the vein of imagination, this was an amazing thing, a book to read about, written in 1922, and yet could have been written last week from reading about it and its construction. It just sounds absolutely beautiful and amazing. Something Jan Carson might enjoy, probably has read because she's read everything. So can you tell me about this book that you returned to over over and again.
So I was absolutely riveted by this book the first time I read it, and I buy it for people and I reread it. It's Lady and the Fox by David Garnett, and it's only 90 pages long. It came out in 1922, as you say, in the same year as Ulysses, and it's a fable. An English gentleman's wife unexpectedly turns into a fox, and the difficulties then that arise from that are outlined. It's a tiny piece of art. It's deceptively simple. The prose isn't polished, and the format is quite casual, as if you're hearing a story at the end of a long evening while you're waiting for a lift home. It's a surrealist story, but it's told in this realist fashion. And yeah, Miss Sylvia, as she's called sometimes, or Mrs. Tebrick, is a woman happily married who suddenly turns into a fox while she and her husband are out walking in the woods. And it's about feminism and free love. And we're seeing the breakdown of a marriage brought about by what could be perceived as the fundamental incompatibility between the sexes. But it's not a hard-hitting lecture. It's quite gentle. It's about generosity of spirit and being open-minded. So Sylvia's husband is rather controlling and traditional. But when she turns into a fox, he's sympathetic. He still loves her. And then it's just quite charming the way we see her foxy nature manifest itself. For example, she always wants to go outside, and he's keeping her in the house because he's afraid of her being shot, or, you know, going into a trap, or dogs chasing her. But she's able to communicate with him through her eyes, and he does finally take her outside. And then she sees the ducks and the pond, and she makes a beeline for them. Ducks are starting quacking and getting very distressed, and the narrator is trying to understand, but my wife couldn't attack ducks. And there's another occasion where he starts reading to her, and all of a sudden he realizes she's just not paying attention. But she's riveted by something in the room, and he follows her eyes, and it's her pet dove in a cage, and she's just staring fixedly at this dove. And so he's slowly coming to terms with the fact that the wife he had is not the wife he has, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And the author Garnett was part of the Bloomsbury set. And this was a bohemian group of intellectuals and artists and literary types who practiced free love and open relationships. And Garnett was bisexual himself. So although, look, we have social satire, we have absurdity, we have wit, we have understatement, there's also a view that Sylvia the fox represents Garnett's male lover, Duncan Grant. And there are some clues to that. For example, the narrator worries about what people will think when he's out and about with this fox partner. So, and one of the other interesting things about this beautiful little book is that there are some gorgeous woodcut illustrations. Oh,
really? I was going to ask you about that, because that's actually what I visualised, not like lino cut, but a woodcut, and that kind of...
Lovely little woodcuts. For example, showing the fox wearing a dress, because of course the narrator wants his wife to still wear beautiful things, and then finally the fox just bites off the clothing. So there's one of a fox in a dress chasing quacking ducks, and there's another one of the fox asleep in what used to be his wife's armchair, but all curled up, a bit like my pet cat. Interestingly, the woodcuts were done by, the illustrations were done by Garnett's first wife, Ray Garnett. And he also wrote aspects of love on which the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical was based. So very imaginative. He was a bookseller as well. This is just, it's only 90 pages.
I was going to say, there's an awful lot going in on in that for 90 pages for such a short, for such a tiny little book. And so it's so weighty themes, but it also sounds just absolutely beautiful. Like, for all the weightiness of it, it sounds like it wears it very lightly. As you say, charming is the word.
It's almost like the kind of story that you'd expect Oscar Wilde to tell.
Yeah, sounds
but
a bit.
I think Oscar would have polished it more, and this is not a polished format.
Yeah, you were saying it's more casual. It's more sort of
It isn't beautiful language as such.
And am I being obtuse here that it's not very well known? I mean, maybe it is, and I just, you know, yet another book I haven't heard of. Is it well known in certain circles, do you think, or is it just?
It's well known in certain circles. It did win a number of quite prestigious awards in 1922 when it came out. But, you know, books get forgotten as well. There's a lovely illustration, I'm just flicking through it as I talk to you, of the fox up a tree and a child looking at it.
It sounds a bit Aesop's fable-y as well, in some sort of a way. Well, maybe that's just because there's a fox in it, but, you know.
Interesting you should say that, because there is a dark underbelly to it as well.
Yeah, I like that. A little sort of sinister edge to it.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, bringing us on quite neatly there with darkness. I was having a little read up on Mary Shelley this morning. I kind of, like everybody, knew a little bit, but hadn't come across her diaries before, hadn't read about sort of when she was writing Your Next Choice, which I can say is Frankenstein. But when she was writing it, I didn't realise that she had a baby and then got pregnant straight away, and was probably breastfeeding the second child when she wrote Frankenstein. But her diaries around that time are all sort of, they're quite nightmarish, really. With the first baby, it was like she didn't name the baby, and the idea of namelessness, but also that she's just, you can sort of nearly tell the sleep deprivation and the, like, out of bodiness nearly of her own self. But I had no idea that's when she began Frankenstein, that's when she began writing it, like going through all of that.
Yeah, she was only a teenager when she wrote it. It's absolutely a novel that stands the test of time 2 centuries on. And it's a story which exerts a gripping hold over us. You know, it's this highly original work with a mythic life of its own. And of course, the character of Frankenstein's monster has become a lasting symbol.
Yeah.
The monster has no name. Or is it a monster, even the terminology?
Yeah.
Such a vivid act of the imagination. So it's about how a man interacts with his creator. And the monster, which is what it's called, I mean, I feel a bit mean calling it a monster, but the monster is critical of his maker. And Frankenstein disowns the monster, but the two are interdependent. And we see the monster find his way in the world. You know, he's searching for food, he's discovering fire, he's learning how to speak. And then he criticizes Frankenstein for rejecting him. He says he was born good, but misery made him a fiend. There's a quote in it, "Make me happy and I shall again be virtuous," he says. And he wants a mate. He wants Frankenstein to create a mate for him. And I have to say, all the reader's sympathy is with the monster.
Yeah.
Mary Shelley imbues him with pathos. And it's interesting that comes across to a greater extent even in the film version, say the Boris Karloff interpretation.
And there's so much to draw from Frankenstein. There's been so many analogies of so many different, do you know what I mean? I don't know how many theses have been written on it. It's inspired so much other work. You know, you could choose any aspect of it and go deeper and deeper and deeper. But for you personally, what did it bring to you? What did it teach you, either about your own craft, about writing, or anything else?
Well, I suppose I was very struck by the perennial themes. And that's important to remember as a writer. You know, you're not reinventing the wheel, because human emotion doesn't alter over the centuries. For me, it was about the dilemma of what makes someone a man or a woman. Is it birth or is it creation? Mm-hmm. And I was very struck by how modern a concept this was for someone to have explored 2 centuries ago. In the current era, we have cloning, we have fertility treatments, we have the prospect of whether robots might become sentient beings. But Mary Shelley was looking at this, you know, in the early 1800s. And then another theme is a question of where does humanity end and the monstrous, if it is monstrous, begin? And then there's also the idea of humankind trying and being unable to control nature. That sounds very modern. I mean, for my money, Victor Frankenstein, the creator, is thoroughly unlikable. There's a line in it I've pulled out. By the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard and a convulsive motion agitated its limbs. There's nothing she doesn't know about writing ghosty stories. Yeah. There's something else I'd love to mention about it. At that time, people said, oh, Shelley, the great poet, wrote this. People struggled to believe that Mary Shelley had done it herself. Partly because I think, well, we can work out why, but yeah. Also there was a manuscript with his notes written on it. And I mean, look, he may have given a little bit of help with editing or suggestions, but it's obviously Mary Shelley's work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, even just a glimpse through her diaries would show that.
And of course, her mother was a famous feminist, Mary Wollstonecraft, who leapt from Putney Bridge into the Thames in the depths of depression, but was rescued and brought back to life to her extreme annoyance. And these apparent resurrections must have all helped to fuel Mary Shelley's imagination.
I'd say so. And like,
scientists at the time were conducting experiments, like shooting electrical currents into dismembered frogs' legs to make them twitch. And there were experiments with reanimating hanged criminals. So she was turning into fiction some of the scientific debate that was happening all around her.
And that idea of, you know, make me good or you know, what is inside each of us. You know, I'm thinking of your novel Sisterland, actually. You know, that even starting out with an idea of a utopia or what might be a utopia, you know, ultimately corrupted by us.
The idea that utopia doesn't exist. Yes, I mean, with About Sisterland, which is set in the near future in a world ruled by women, I intended it to be a utopia. Of course I did. And then as I wrote it, I realised, no, this is a dystopia because women ruling the world wouldn't make everything perfect because we're human beings first and women second and human beings... whether male or female, are going to be susceptible to ambition and power and thinking they know best.
Yeah, it's power, isn't it? Power is the big one.
Power corrupts all. Power corrupts, absolutely.
And it's just a fascinating, I can't remember who, was it Cloud Atlas, David Mitchell? Just that, yeah, that central kind of impetus, kind of malign most of the time, that is in everybody, even if you really disavow it in yourself, you know, can surprise you sometimes, even a little taste of it. It's fascinating. I mean, does that run through a lot of your novels?
Sidelined women, really, I think, would be a common denominator. If I think of the kinds of characters I'm drawn to writing about, it's either women who are forgotten or women who are silenced, mm-hmm. or women who are reduced to two-dimensional figures when they were so much more rounded in that. But hopefully it's not always done in a whatabouty fashion.
Not a whatabouty.
Hopefully.
Never. Perish the thought.
Well, I mean, maybe there's a bit of whatabouty, but then I go and take it out if I can, you know, that's the thing.
I sort of don't want to pry as well with some of these questions, because The next one I wanted to ask you is about, you know, difficult points in your life. And I know it's not always easy to talk about, but, you know, books can be there for us as like signposts, whatever's going on with us. And we all go through, everyone in their own different ways goes through these periods in life. But you've two books that you've mentioned here that were either, I don't know whether they were companions or they helped you or that you just happened to be in them at the time or what way they kind of spoke to your experiences. But you've mentioned two books that were there at a difficult point in your life.
So those are 12,000 Days by Eilish Neidhöfner and The Year of Magical Thinking by Joan Didion. And they're memoirs of love and loss, both. I think in Eilish's case, the emphasis is on love. And she is a wise, witty, true writer. And there's hope at the end of that memoir about the loss of her husband and coming to terms with grief. It doesn't leave you feeling morbid and unhappy, quite the reverse. You see her tending his grave, remembering the happy times. Then The Year of Magical Thinking, it talks about the process of grief and loss and how, in Joan Didion's case, it can leave her empty of joy. And I found that interesting because I didn't get that sense with Eilish's work. She was not empty of joy.
Mm-hmm.
So The Year of Magical Thinking is her account of the year following the death of her husband and her attempts to make sense of that grief. And I suppose it's exacerbated for her because their adopted daughter, well, I shouldn't even say adopted daughter, their daughter is severely ill. And Didion is trying to sort out that situation, but she's also fixated on the months leading up to his death as though she could turn back the clock and change outcomes. You see that a bit too in 12,000 Days by Eilish Neidhöfner. She's going back over the run-up. What if I got him to the hospital quicker? What if I'd noticed quicker? But hers is more upbeat, definitely.
It's back to that outcomes thing again when you were talking at the start about Proxopero. You know that if this is memoirs, so it's truth. It's not fiction. You can't change the outcome. There is an inevitability there. But that's, well, you're saying empty of joy. That's interesting.
Well, you know, of course, people react to grief or to challenges in a different way. So, for example, Didion refuses to give away her husband's clothes and shoes, believing that he'll need them when he returns to her. And she calls this belief that her thoughts and her hopes and her wishes can alter reality. She calls it magical thinking.
Magical thinking.
And she finds lots of examples of this behavior in the literature she studies on grief and mourning, from poems and novels to etiquette books. And I was interested in that because I could not wait to give away all my mother's belongings after she died. And I was doling out things on the day we buried her, which clearly was foolish of me because I gave away things I would have preferred to keep. But I was doing it in a sense of celebration and sharing because I love the idea of objects being associated with people. And I wanted those who'd come to her funeral, nieces and cousins and friends, I wanted them to
have something
belonging to her and then that they would look at it and think of Bridie.
Yes, no, I can understand that. I was thinking you're coming at that from a much more celebratory place, whereas I was thinking, yes, get it all away so I don't have to have any, you know, any reminders or any just have it over with, which is also not a very healthy attitude, but I can understand that too.
I do like things belonging to my parents. Like I'm looking around my study now and I can see my father's much, much loved bookends. They're crossed hurling sticks. He played hurling as a young man and they were one of his prized possessions. And I have them now and they're there. And I wear some of my mother's clothes. I wear a nice silk dressing gown I bought her when she was ill. I'm wearing one of her rings. I would like to think of people wearing and enjoying my possessions. I mean, they'll probably end up in a charity shop, and that's okay too. It doesn't have to be people who knew me.
Sorry, I have to be brief there. I lost both my parents this year, so it's it's fine. It's just, you know, when we talk about this kind of stuff, but it's very interesting to know how everyone has just a different way of dealing with it, and particularly about memorabilia and all of that kind of stuff. I just find that almost, but luckily my siblings did all the hard work up there, so I wasn't there to dismantle the house and all of that. So I got off scot-free there, not having to go through that process. I just don't think I could. I'd rather just click a switch and it all to disappear, which I, like you, maybe might regret then in a year's time. Would say, oh, I wish I'd, you know, kept that or seen that, rather than just, okay, it's all gone.
Well, I dismantled the house after my mother died. My father had died some years earlier, and it was a hard thing to do. I was there on my own doing it. But then towards the end of the day, two of my brothers finished work and came over and took me out to dinner, which was lovely. But I found two wonderful things while I was doing that dismantling that might have got thrown on a skip otherwise. One was the telegram that my father sent to Granny in County Limerick, saying that their first son had been born, my eldest brother. It was just this lovely telegram, few lines saying, you know, delighted to tell you that mother and son are both well. No, son was born today and so forth. And so I found that and I gave it to Frank, my eldest brother, and he has it framed now in his house, which is lovely. Obviously, it only happened for the first child. After that, they relied on letters and so forth. But because wouldn't it have been fabulous to have that telegram for yourself? And then the other thing I found was a little remnant of wallpaper in a box, and my heart nearly stopped with excitement and the return of memory, because it was the wallpaper that had been in my bedroom as a baby and then a very little girl. And I had forgotten it till I saw it, but the moment I saw it, I recognized it. It was pale lemon with a little fluffy gray and white cats playing sport, playing tennis and golf and playing ball. And as soon as I saw it, I was a child in a cot. I had a flashback.
Oh my gosh.
Standing, holding the bars of my cot and looking at all those little cats playing their sport. And I knew I had been loved.
You're destroying me.
But objects, you see, really do bring back memories.
They do. They do. It's
true. They unlock memories that you don't even know you have.
Mm-hmm. I know, the swirl of a carpet or the turn of a tread of a stair, all of it. Yeah, no, I totally get that.
But, you know, there wasn't much money. Like, my father was a bus driver and my mother worked in the home and there were seven of us. But they went out and spent hard-earned, hard-to-come-by money on this frivolous, frothy wallpaper.
Yeah. Cats playing golf. Yeah. No, it's gorgeous. Right, we need to talk about books that make you laugh now, just so we can. So what, like, and I always said, so much harder for a writer to make you laugh than make you cry. It's such a gift. So and I have a little separate list that I have from Burning Books of books that make you laugh, because I think they're much needed. So can you tell us about your book, a book that makes you laugh or uplifts you?
Well, a book that I'm reading at the moment is making me laugh. It's by Andrew Meehan and it's The Mystery of Love. And it's a fictionalized account of the relationship between Oscar Wilde and his wife, Constance. And I was surprised by how funny it was. I mean, there's also anger and pain in it, but there's so much humor. It's quite cinematic because he's also a screenwriter. And he brings this discipline to the work. But really, it's imagining the scenes of their domestic life. It's intimate.
Oh.
It's really vivid. And he does something very, very funny, which is it's Constance's story. And, you know, rightly, she's a bit peeved, really, by what happens. As we know, Oscar's imprisoned because of having bisexual, sorry, having, well, I suppose he must have been bisexual as well, married and had children. But obviously he's gay and he's imprisoned because of it, because of admitting it, because of, you know, the court case. And so she's annoyed that their life has been upended. But it's also very funny. It's her story, and Oscar is reduced to footnotes. So she'll say something in the book, and then there'll be a little asterisk, and there at the bottom there'll be Oscar's voice.
Brilliant.
I seem to remember rather differently. And I think this is so clever.
That's a great device. Really clever way of doing it.
I really admire what he did.
So that's the mystery of love. So that's the book, his previous novel, is it? Because I know he's another one out now, Instant Fires.
Yes, that's right, Instant Fires. This is his second novel. And I think this is just really deserves to be much better known.
Brilliant. I'm going to get a hold of that, particularly for any laughs. They're golden at the moment. So, okay, The Mystery of Love.
Yeah, and it's about the early days of their courtship as well, you know, and the marriage. And it speculates on whether Constance knew about Oscar's sexuality, or, you know, how much of it she did. And interestingly, it has her brother warn her off marrying him, but she's undeterred. And you know, Meehan is reflecting on what it was they saw in each other. The title of the book comes from an Oscar Wilde phrase in Salome. He uses the term The Mystery of Love.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Anyway, I'm really, really enjoying it. I almost read it in one take. I liked it so much, but exhaustion set in and I had to go to bed.
Martina, two difficult questions now, but the fun questions. So one of your own books that you would save from the burning house over all the others, and you know you've written, and I know you don't like to say the word genre, so I'm not going to use it, but you've written lots of different books with different hearts and souls. So which of those would you hang on to if you had to pick one?
The House Where It Happened, which is my witchcraft novel, 2014, and it's just a book really that stays with me, and that people keep coming across and emailing me or speaking to me about when I meet them. It's a book I was never able to completely leave aside and move on from, you know, because it's a funny thing. So I've written 11 books and also two plays and, you know, tediously endless amounts of journalism for people. But The House Where It Happened is set in 1711 in Island Magee in County Antrim, and it's about a real life witchcraft trial, fictionalized account. And my head exploded when I stumbled across it. I can still taste my sense of amazement and how did I not know about this? So there's a wee section in newspapers called It Happened This Day, and I just remember clearly, as I'm talking now, I can see it in front of me. It said, on this day, 1711, 8 women were convicted of witchcraft in Carrickfergus, County Antrim. That's where the assizes were. And I thought, 8 women, that's a mass witchcraft trial. And then my next thought was, well, why do I not know about it? Why didn't I learn about it at school? And my third thought was, well, what happened to them? How can you just tell me one sentence and not let me know, did they live or die? What was their outcome? So I went off and researched the story and was able to read witness depositions to the court. And
so that was all available, witness depositions to the court?
The witness depositions exist, and accounts of the trial.
Goodness.
And I mean, fundamentally, one young woman called Mary Dunbar pointed the finger at 8 other women, and her evidence was uncorroborated.
Oh my God.
Had alibis, and they weren't allowed to count. And I became I became increasingly invested in these eight women. They were all from Ulster Scots Presbyterian background, and Mary Dunbar was from that world as well, but from a higher social class. And there was a word I kept coming across when I was reading about her, including the Vicar of Belfast's account, because it was a cause celebre, and the great and the good came to the trial, and the Vicar of Belfast asked to meet her and wrote about it afterwards, and people kept saying she was pretty. So you have a young, pretty person pointing the finger at where ugly in some way. Two of them were lame. One of them had very bad scars on her face. Another of them was regarded as a bit of a fishwife. You know, any woman basically who stood up on her hind legs and didn't fit societal perceived norms was at risk here. So I became utterly obsessed with that story, and I think I probably still am. And after I wrote the novel, I became vexed, more and more vexed, that there was nothing to say that these women had lived or died. I hadn't been able to find a grave. They were poor women. And I was really desperate for some sort of memorial to them, some sort of plaque. And I lobbied and lobbied and spoke to the local council, and I just wanted something and still want something just to acknowledge.
So nothing came of that? There isn't a plaque or an acknowledgement?
Not somewhere. Yet. Not yet. I remain hopeful and I continue to, you know, push for it if at all possible.
Am I allowed to ask? I mean, I know you were asking there. I don't want to ruin the novel for anybody, but just in reality, did you ever, so you say there wasn't a grave, but did you ever find out what happened to them at all?
Oh, yes. Yes, I did. Okay. Yes, okay. I did. It was all noted down. Yeah. Okay. So they were found guilty, and they were both lucky and unlucky. They were lucky that they were convicted under the Irish Witchcraft Act rather than the Scottish or English Witchcraft Act.
Goodness me.
Because the sentence for a first offence in Ireland was a year and a day in prison and turns in the stocks or the pillory. But, for example, in Scotland, a first offence was execution. God. So, yeah, they were jailed. And then, I mean, look, jail wasn't for the faint-hearted then.
No.
Being locked into the stocks on Fair Day when Carrickfergus would be full wasn't a very pleasant experience either. And one poor soul had her eye put out by some yahoo wrapping a rock in a cabbage leaf and hurling it at her. And then when they were released from prison, I mean, they went back into their communities. But can you imagine how welcome they would have been there? I mean,
it's just horrifying. And like, yeah, how do we not know about it? I mean, and as I was saying to you before we started there, I grew up not far from Isle of Magee, and you know that there was never heard of it before. Never heard of that. And you think it would be something? It'd be something you'd all do your projects on primary school. Or
well, I wanted to be taught in schools, and I have gone around and given talks there, and that's what I want. I want people to remember the story.
Yeah.
Because every age has its witches. We just call them by different names.
So that is the house where it happened. If you haven't read that before, that should be on your list. I'm going to let you go soon, Martina, but before you do, I want to ask you, my favourite question is, which book would you leave in the house to burn and why?
Well, you know, I don't even write my name in books, let alone scribble down the side. So the idea of damaging a book in any shape or form is anathema to me. Like, books were treasured possessions in our house because there wasn't much money and a book was a big present. But if I had a Sophie's Choice and really, really, really had to, I think Finnegan's Wake by James Joyce. I think it is the most overrated book ever, ever, ever. And I speak as someone who loves Dubliners, loves the dead, likes his play Exiles, even though it didn't do that well. I teach Joyce at university currently for Boston University students. But I just think Finnegan's Wake. Joyce, you'd have been better just stopping at Ulysses.
I'm afraid it's joining Ulysses in there, because I think Jan Carson threw Ulysses in the house in the flames.
So you can't put Ulysses in, if only for one reason, which is the Molly Bloom soliloquy at the end, which is magnificent and ends with that string of yeses, which is just so positive. Yes, I said, yes, I will. Yes. Also, I wrote a play based this year, based on the Nora Barnacle James Joyce relationship, she was so influential in his work. I mean, even that Molly Bloom soliloquy, which is stream of consciousness. Nora Barnacle spoke in a kind of stream of consciousness herself. And he had great respect for her. And I think that comes across in the work. I mean, she is Bertha in Exiles. She is Molly in Ulysses. She is Greta in The Dead, which is perhaps my favorite piece of work by Joyce, The Dead. I love that. Snow falling gently, falling all over Ireland. This is free interpretation, falling in the living and the dead.
Just the pentameter of that is so gorgeous. Martina, I don't know if you have something for us to read from to finish off.
From one of my books or from one of someone else's books?
Whatever you prefer, really. It's just it's nice just to end on a little reading.
If you wouldn't mind, then I'll read from my latest novel, Edith. And what you need to know is that Edith Somerville, the Irish RM co-author, is staying with George Bernard Shaw, who's a relative by marriage. And Edith continued writing under the Somerville and Ross dual signature, believing that she was collaborating with Ross beyond the grave. So Ross is dead by this stage, but we're still getting Somerville and Ross novels. So she's at dinner with Shaw, and he asks her about spiritualism. Shaw cuts in and quizzes Edith on spiritualism. "Well, it helps me to navigate my life. Sounds like tomfoolery and worse. The vulnerable and recently bereaved are exploited. Well, I'm not the exploitable type." "Charlotte," Shaw's wife says, "I'd like to try automatic writing. A parlour game for the susceptible." It occurs to Edith that he's amusing himself with her as a cat toys with a mouse. Two can play at that game. She pivots to her cousin. "We can try some automatic writing after dinner if you like, Charlotte. Would you care to join us, George?" "Certainly not. It's the unconscious mind at work, and of my own unconscious, I am naturally unconscious." "Do you really speak to the dead, Edith?" asks Charlotte. "The so-called dead? Of course I do. The messages are part of a repressed personality." "Then perhaps useful for self-discovery, darling. If you were drunk, would you say it was the real you emerging? How can a trance be any more true? It's self-delusion, utter poppycock." "Darling, you're being dreadfully cranky." "Having now reached the age of Methuselah, I'm entitled to be cranky."
You've been listening to the exceptional Martina Devlin, reading from her new book, Edith, out now with Lilliput Press. The next Burning Books will be live from the new theatre in Temple Bar on the 11th of November, when I'll be talking with poet Liz Quirk and author Andrew Meehan for the Dublin Book Festival. See you all then.